Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to a very special edition of Web Sleuths Radio, Thursday night edition of Web Sleuths Radio. My name is Tricia Griffith. As always with us, my producer Bessie, who does all the heavy lifting, and I am welcoming back a guest we had on a few weeks ago, Anne Penn. Now, Anne wrote this amazing book called Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer. It's a book about the East Area Rapist. And the last time Anne was on, we didn't get to go deep inside the victims and exactly how this happened and some of the details of the whole of this serial killer. And that's what we're going to do tonight. And Anne, welcome back. I am so glad you joined us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, let's talk about the reason why you wrote the book and why you wrote it like you did. You wrote it like a journal or a conversation.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I wrote it because I was compelled to. I think I've said before, it was a story that wouldn't go away. It kept popping up and all the strangest places, and I couldn't get away from it, appeared. So I decided to deal with the fear that I had and also try to investigate a little bit and figure out how to sort of, I guess, put it someplace that was a little more comfortable for myself. And mm-hmm. and in so doing, it's been a journey that I didn't quite anticipate where it's taking me, but here we are. So.
And why did you write it like a journal or a conversation? Was that just easier for you to do, or was there a specific reason?
I like to write the way that I speak. The objective mm-hmm. was to keep it focused on the subject matter, which is about how a young man started out attacking and raping women and girls. And I have my opinions about it. I also had tried to set up kind of what the world was like back in the late 60s, early 70s, and going forward, because it was a different place. Obviously, there were no computers, no media the way it is now. And the world was a little more innocent back then. So, and when you keep that in context, it really helps understand a little bit why this guy ended up getting away with what he got away with. So.
And he certainly did get away with a lot. We're still looking for him. Let's talk about the times. And why do you think, speaking of getting away, why do you think the East Area Rapist was allowed to, I mean, I don't want to use the word allowed, but why did he get away? And what about the times of the attack? Are they relevant in some way? Let's talk about that.
Well, I was saying, I know that it appears to me, and many others, I'm sure, that this guy decided somewhere along the way that he wanted to not fit in into normal society, and he wanted to be a serial killer. I think he started out mm-hmm. doing the peeping and breaking in and then wanted to eventually become comfortable with raping and then, you know, being in control of a situation where he could control the husband or the significant other and mm-hmm. do what he wanted to do. So I think he originally, the reason I wrote the book with the title Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer, is because I do think it was his intention from the first moments he started committing crimes, even if it was just breaking into a home. His ultimate mm-hmm. goal was to eventually become a serial killer, and that's what I think, and I think there are a lot of others who may believe the same thing.
So let's get back to the title. I meant to talk to you about that first. Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer, that was written because this is what you feel he was working up to. This is kind of his goal, his graduation, if you will, right?
Right. I do think that. I just think he needed the practice and the confidence and the skills to become a serial killer. And he didn't want to just be a serial killer. He wanted to be the one who wasn't going to be caught, and that really was his intention, and he succeeded up to this point.
Well, he certainly has, and that's the tragedy of this whole thing. So he was working mm-hmm. up basically to be a serial killer, and he got away mm-hmm. with these crimes. It was a different, like you said, it was a different time. I don't even think mm-hmm. we had the word serial killer out there at that time, and he just kind of got a jump on law enforcement. So law enforcement of the 70s, different jurisdictions, they didn't really interact like they do today. There's still problems with interaction today, but you know, back then they didn't have the computers and everything. And did people argue, was this the same guy? Were certain crimes investigated differently? They didn't have any cell phones, no DNA. Forensics today, it just blows
right.
what they had, blows it out of the water, what they had back in those days. So talk to us about that, about law enforcement and how it was different back then.
Well, you know, it really was. I mean, jurisdictions weren't tied together. There was no database that was connected. There was, you know, no CODIS the way it is. And again, the times were where people just didn't talk to each other. Even the people who were witnesses or who were in neighborhoods and heard things and saw things didn't report it to authorities. Many times they just didn't get involved, and it was a more of an innocent time. I mean, people didn't think that something was wrong when it was really wrong. They thought things were firecrackers when they heard gunshots and so on. And so that was, you know, law enforcement did everything they could possibly do to try to stop this guy, but he was he caught a lot of breaks as well. So, you know, in the beginning there was an article about how the East Area rapist crawled out of a drainage ditch. And the reality is that's exactly what he did all over Sacramento. He used waterways and stuff to travel. And it was absolutely a brilliant move on his part. It made it easier for him to escape. So he was a new kind of criminal.
Can I ask you something about that? Because that is very unusual. And when you say he used waterways, are you talking about he walked through the sewer and then came up? Or what are you talking about exactly?
Well, he used creeks, different areas, you know, throughout. There are a lot of drainage ditches all throughout Sacramento because it's one of those areas mm-hmm. that can flood. And so there's waterways all over the American River. There's the Sacramento River. There's just a lot of different levees and different places he could go. And he used them to his advantage. And that was some of the ways he got away on foot, I'm sure, you know, when he wasn't riding a bicycle or some other form of transportation. But it was absolutely a brilliant move on his part. So
it wasn't. And continue, I'm not sure if you touched on this, the forensics, compare it to what they had back then as to today. I mean, they really didn't have anything.
I don't know, really, because I was just a kid, really, when this began. But, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, when you compare it to what they have today, it was very rudimentary and it was very basic, you know. So I kind of like to get into that a little bit later on in our talk, if that's okay.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, have some questions, actually, for people about DNA and evidence and law enforcement and what's been done. But back in the beginning, when they, like everybody who heard about the rapes in East Sacramento, everybody who was there at the time and lived through it, it was very unnerving. So, you know, downtown Sacramento, I mean, he was really wandering all over the area, probably because he lived in that area. But everybody was worried about it. Everybody remembers him. If you talk to people even now, they go, gee, I remember that guy, but they think he was caught. A lot of my old friends from the area think that he was caught. They have no idea that he progressed to become a serial killer. They just didn't have a clue.
You did bring up a great point in that law enforcement did not talk to each other. It was a different time. Nowadays, if we see somebody kind of strange hanging around, we'll call the police. Now, that's what happened with Polly Klass's killer. He was standing across the street looking at her window, and people thought, what a weird guy. Nobody called the police. And I'm like you said, the East Area rapist, he caught a lot of breaks, which is why he got away. Today, if he started, he wouldn't be able to do it, I don't think. Do you?
No, I don't think he would today because of all the media, the people with cell phones with pictures and so on. This guy, though, he continued his attacks for almost 2 years in East Sacramento and then in the South area as well. And his MO was to terrorize and rape women, basically, and to control men. But he didn't care if the person was 13 or you know, 25. He really didn't care at all.
That's what makes him so terrifying. Newspaper articles at the time and other articles let's talk about that. Very different time again back in the 70s. Why don't you address the newspaper articles?
Well, some of the things that, there were a lot of articles that came out when he was first striking all over Sacramento. One of them is, there was an article in the newspaper the day Elvis Presley died, for example, and I'm sure he loved reading that article because it was there next to when Elvis died, and it says, "Clue to Rapist at Last." I mean, he had so many articles written about him for 25-plus attacks, and all of a sudden, you know, there's one that's here about a girl who was 13 and was attacked off College Greens and Watt Avenue, and he broke in through a sliding glass door, and he spent about 2 hours in the home, and he was raping the girl and fondling her as she sat tied in a chair. I mean, how sick is that? He threatened the girl's mother, and he put dishes on her back and said if he heard the dishes rattle, he'd cut off her daughter's fingers. And this is after 25 attacks in Sacramento over the course of 2 years. Mm-hmm. And can you imagine how the people in Sacramento were? They're like,
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean, they were, you know, he was attacking in Sacramento, and you were around there. I'm not sure exactly where you were, but I'm sure you're very worried too, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was totally. Yeah, I was more careful, and I was worried about it. I thought about it. I heard about it. I read about it. He was a terrorist, and his articles were in the paper for 2 years, and he just kept on doing what he was doing. In December 1977. They saw a masked bike rider at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and they spotted this. Law enforcement spotted him two times within 2 hours, but they somehow didn't stop him. I have no idea exactly why, because it doesn't say. But it says the officer said later that the masked bike rider probably was not the rapist. Probably.
How would they know?
I thought that was interesting. Well, who rides around at 2 o'clock in the morning with a mask on their face? You know.
Exactly.
In the areas
where
the rapist was striking. So
right, I would say that was more than likely him. I mean, just to blatantly come out and say, well, that probably wasn't him, that's ridiculous. More than likely it was him, because people don't go out riding their bikes at 2 a.m. Let's talk about the actual murders. You mentioned the one about the 13-year-old, and he put dishes on the back of the mother. Terrifying,
well, that was
horrible.
Just,
but
was,
I don't...
That wasn't the murders yet. That was just the way he attacked and what the rapes were about in Sacramento. That was his MO.
Let's talk about the murders so people will realize just how dangerous this guy is. So please continue.
Well, like I said, he ended up going in different jurisdictions, and so it just really made it easier for him to wander off into different areas like in Danville and Goleta. He attacked in Goleta. That's when the first murders began. And the newspaper articles were written at the time were really simple, and they didn't have too many facts, and they didn't talk about the gruesomeness of the scenes. They just basically say, well, you know, two bodies were found and people were murdered. But what I want to say about that is, When the East Area Rapist became a murderer, you know, if in fact he killed the Maggiores in Rancho Cordova, and if in fact he killed Professor Snelling in Visalia, he used a gun. And we don't have proof that he did those things, but if he did, he was prepared to use a gun, and he killed all three of these people in cold blood. And he used the gun easily, and we have proof of that. He shot a kid who dared to chase him over a fence, and the youth was in critical condition. This is still in Sacramento, but he managed to survive. He was shot in the abdomen. And the thing that the people that lived through that, the attacks in the general public in Sacramento, they don't know, they really don't know that he's still free. You know, there are some who do, but there's a lot of people just in the general population that don't have any idea that he became a murderer.
It's just amazing how he got away. Do you have any of the articles that you could read to us to kind of give us an example of what people, people get a small little snippet, and yet there's this horrible rapist/killer going around, and they're not getting the full details. Do you have any of those articles, Andy? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but...
Well, the original Night Stalker, which is what his name became after he left Sacramento, he killed with a gun again in December of 1979, and his victims were Dr. Robert Offerman, who was only 41, and Dr. Deborah Manning, who was only 35, and both of them were shot to death. And the neighbors did hear the shots, but they did think they were holiday firecrackers. They didn't call the police. But the thing is when he killed the Offerman and Manning victims, he I don't know that he was that in control of the scene, because he had to use deadly force, because they think he was challenged by Dr. Offerman. But that did not give him. That didn't give him the time to engage in his little mind games that he liked to play. So so in less than 3 months, he attacked again, and this time he drove to Ventura, California. And what I want to say about that is all murders are horrific. All murders are horrific. But in this particular case, when I think about the fear involved in the Smith murders, I cannot emphasize enough that being bludgeoned to death with a fireplace log while your hands are tied behind your back is absolutely obscene.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And so prior to those attacks... Go ahead.
Oh, please continue. Please continue. You're much more interesting than I am, so continue, please.
Prior to these attacks, it was speculated that the perpetrator watched the Smiths in their bedroom while they made love, and then waited for them to fall asleep before he began his attacks. He killed Lyman first and then used overkill to bludgeon Charlene to death after he raped her. In this case, he did not cover the victims until they were dead, leaving blood spatter on himself and the room.
That is terrible.
You know,
and that's just one of them. Do you have the others? Did any descriptions of the others?
Well, the thing is that... one of the things I wanted to talk about is some of these articles, what they, you know, they start their investigations and they say that they've found these people. In this particular case, a 12-year-old boy found his parents, his father and his stepmother passed away. And anyway, there's just so much that goes into these cases trying to investigate. One of the things that they did say was that they didn't have any enemies, but there was so much speculation about who might have done this. And the other thing, too, that happens is people first look at people that you know, who might have done this that these people knew. And that goes for all murder victims, and that's normally the course of the investigation. I mean, how often is it a random serial killer that comes along and does this? But it really kind of threw this one off completely, because the Ventura County went down the wrong road thinking that it was somebody that they knew. And it took a really long time for people to realize that this was really connected, and a lot of the jurisdictions did not want to admit that they were connected. Santa Barbara had some murders in their county. There were 10 people that were murdered down in Southern California, and... finally, they were connected through DNA testing to determine that they were all connected. So it just took a really long time. And, the cases are cold, you know. So.
Exactly, and it sounded like it took a long time. Part of the big reason would be that the jurisdictions did not communicate with each other. That, to me, that's unfathomable, but that's how it was back then, right? It really was.
Well, and the other thing, too, that's happened, like we were talking about DNA earlier, you know, in this particular case, the medical examiner's office with the Smith murders thought that they were asleep when they were attacked, which was completely wrong. There were all these different conflicting reports about just whether or not she had been raped. I mean, there were articles that said that she hadn't been, and we know that she was. So there were all this misinformation that came out. And I'm not sure why that was, or who, you know, gave that to the media to report. And I know they try to hold back some information. But it was also stated in some of these articles that they were optimistic they would solve the case, and here it is 37 years later.
It's
a frustrating thing, but, you know, to keep waiting.
But, Jesse, do you have a question?
Yeah, but so years later they were able to find out through DNA many years later that some of these were connected. About what year was that? Do you know offhand? I mean, how many years later?
I think it took until about 1999 for a portion of these murders to be connected to the East Area rapists and to each other, and then a little bit longer for the rest.
So by then, any witnesses or even some of the law enforcement officers who were involved were probably, I'm imagining, deceased or out of touch, and they couldn't find them and put them together, you know, put the evidence together or witness statements together to get much information.
Well, different counties had kept information and, you know, crime reports and all that. In the beginning, I think Sacramento, when the statute of limitations ran out in Sacramento, they may have gotten rid of some of their records, but I don't know that for – I'm not an expert, and I don't, you know, pretend to be. I just know that these cases aren't solved yet, and I'm hopeful that they will be. The thing that I guess probably I wanted to say in particular is that these victims need to be remembered, and they were, you know, their lives were taken from them, and it doesn't matter if it's 37 years ago. It doesn't matter if it was yesterday.
It's
something that needs to have some, you know, I hate the word closure, because there really isn't, because when you've been through this as a victim or a family member of a victim, or if you're involved in this in any way, it changes you forever. And so, you know,
no, I prefer the word resolution. I mean, at least they get a resolution and know, you know, who killed their loved ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there was a lot of different misinformation that went out, you know, through the course of time, and a lot of speculation. I mean, some of the headlines were murder of Ventura couple filled with intrigue, or investigators study Orange Ventura County slayings, concerned neighbors. And then 7 months in after the Smith was murdered, it says police closing in. And of course, here we are 37 years later. And I'm not trying to put down anybody who investigates this at all. That is not my intent. I'm just saying that it's very frustrating to wait this long for an identity of who did such horrible things, you know.
So, no, we see that in a lot of old cold cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where there was a lot of misinformation and disconnect in the beginning, and you know, now some of these cold cases have been opened and they're trying to piece it together, but it's very difficult to do so many years later. Like I said, witnesses are gone, you can't get witness statements, some law enforcement officers are deceased or they're not around. So even though you have the police reports, it's still, you don't have that, you know, eyewitness or live witnesses who were around at the time to give their input. But one thing I wanted to ask you, I mean, you said that many people believe that the case was solved.
Yeah, the East Area rapist cases.
So why? Why do they believe that?
Because he went away. He left. And they just forgot about him, and they just, you know, oh, here it is all these years later. I talked to old friends from the area, and I said, do you remember that case? And they say, oh, yeah, wasn't he caught? You know, and so it's just one of the things that people didn't realize that he progressed and became a serial killer. So,
do you have any idea? Go ahead, Bessie,
pardon?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, do you have any ideas, speculation, theory of why he stopped?
You mean after he murdered people?
You say, you know, after a while it just stopped.
Yeah. Well,
do you have any
ideas? He moved on. he moved on out of the area to commit the murders. He may have still lived there and probably still does, but he left and drove different places to commit the crime. So who knows, you know, he just got older and wanted to settle down and knew that if he continued, he was possibly going to get caught because forensics were changing and all the different investigative techniques were changing, and he was smart enough to know when to quit.
So theoretically, either he quit or he moved on and continued to kill, and theoretically some other cases in other areas could be connected. Do you think so?
No, I don't. I think he stopped in 86. The next one that happened after the Smith murders was the murders of Keith and Patrice Harrington, which was 5 months after the Smith murders. That was August of 1980. And it was in a gated community. And they were no less brutal than all the others that took place before or after them. You know, they were young people that were in medical school, and one was a nurse. And
I remember that one.
Raped, and And it was pretty much, from what they said, an identical murder to the Smith murders.
Right.
So once again,
I need to stop you right here because I need to reintroduce everybody, because if anybody's joining us late, they're going, who are these people? We're talking with author Ann Penn. Ann has a new book out called Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer. It's a book about the East Area Rapist. Also with us tonight is my producer, Bessie, and we're talking about the East Area Rapist and going more in depth than we did a few weeks ago when we had Ann on. And we're talking about the victims, and I think that's very important. I think it's extremely important what you're doing, Ann, by going in and describing the murders so people will understand that these things were brutal. And this guy needs to be caught. Let's not just sit back on our behinds and rock and say everything's okay. So you were talking about the victims. Do you have, I'm assuming you have others that you would like to talk about, right?
Sure. Unfortunately.
Okay. Yes, unfortunately.
Bruce Harrington was Keith Harrington's brother, and he helped put together some legislation to make sure that DNA was collected from people that were convicted of felonies and that kind of thing. And so he was instrumental in that. But his brother and Patrice Harrington were murdered at the same hands of this guy. And then he continued on from that point as well. In 1981, found Manuela with him alone. And he murdered her the same way, by bludgeoning her. So what he did was he took the weapons with him at that point, at the first murders with the Smiths and the log that he used to kill them. He got smarter after that and decided to take the murder weapons with him.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate thing is, and one of the things I found kind of interesting about the fact that he murdered Manuela, the articles in the newspaper were really not as detailed, and they sort of seemed to have run their investigation, I want to say, to an end within a year. It looked like they kind of gave up looking for the killer. There were also other murders. Sherry Domingo and Greg Sanchez were also a couple of other victims, and that happened in 1981.
What about, who is Lisa, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but Lisa D'Ambrosia?
No, that's
Leslie.
That's an investigator. She's,
We'll talk about her in a minute, but do we have any more, unfortunately, do we have any more victims that you would like to discuss?
Well, once again, every one of them was bludgeoned to death, and then also Mr. Sanchez was shot in the face. So, again, this happened in Goleta. So, you know, there were many, many people who were murdered by this person.
And bludgeoning to death is a horrible, horrible way to die. If anybody watches it, The Walking Dead, when Glenn was killed, like you and I were talking earlier, Anne, that the network got a lot of complaints because it was so graphic, the way his head was bludgeoned in. And unfortunately, that's what happened to these people. I mean, there is no good murder, absolutely not. But when someone goes in and bludgeons somebody over the head, that's a whole different thing. You're angry. You want this person to just be obliterated. And I can't imagine how the victims' families feel after all these years. Just awful. Just absolutely awful. And I'm sure they're waiting for justice as well. But, and you
now,
actually, go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things that that really kind of struck me too was that for a young guy driving around in a car, trying to get to a different place to do these kinds of things, to put the geography in perspective, he went from Goleta to Laguna Niguel, which is Dana Point. It takes the longest distance between these places took 2 hours and 32 minutes to go from one place to another. So he traveled around from Goleta to Ventura to Irvine to, you know, all these different places. And they really weren't that far away from each other. And the other thing that was surrounded in those areas was Santa Rosa Creek. And, that's one of the waterways, once again, that he used to escape.
Right. And that, of course, would make it difficult for search dogs at the time, to track him if he was using waterways. I mean, we didn't have some of the... The dogs weren't trained the way they are now.
That's a very
good
point.
That would cut off the search,
yeah.
That's terrible.
It is. I just want to make sure that we... Go ahead.
No, you go. I was just going to say bludgeoning is just the most horrible. Because you don't necessarily die immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And you can live, for several minutes or longer if you've been bludgeoned and the pain and the feeling of helplessness and it's just horrible, horrible way to die.
It is. It's a horrible image. And I want to make sure that we do talk about all of the victims because I know that's important. It's important to you. It's important to me. So unfortunately, there probably are more victims, so please continue.
Well, one of the things that, there is a logical progression to what happened here. And, there were people talking to each other in different jurisdictions. Law enforcement was trying to figure this out, there was an article in the Sacramento Bee on March 13th, 1980, the same day in Ventura County that the original Night Stalker murdered Lyman and Charlene Smith. And what was interesting about that to me is... It says this: there is a difference of opinion among detectives investigating the possibility that a double homicide in Santa Barbara County was committed by Sacramento's East Area Rapist. They didn't believe that the killings in Goleta were connected. They kind of went back and forth, and different detectives talked to each other. There was a Sergeant Bevins who felt that there was a connection, that he was the same guy. And then there were others who didn't feel that way. But while they were busy going back and forth, what was interesting to me with this particular article was it came out in the Sacramento Bee on the same day of the night that the Smiths were murdered. And,
Kind of propelled him to kill that night, do you think?
I don't really know. I just thought it was an interesting coincidence that the date was the same. Ventura County did look in the wrong places originally, and they did almost try to prosecute somebody that the Smiths knew. But sometimes he would use a gun, and sometimes he bludgeoned and used a gun. And, so it's an interesting progression. But like I said, he did... take a break for about 5 years after 1981. He stopped doing anything that we can tell, and then he decided to go back to less than 2 miles away from Manuela Whitten's home. He went to Janelle Cruz's home and murdered her on May 4th, 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And he used complete overkill in this particular case, and they were pretty sure that it was Janelle Cruz. But they actually had to use dental records to make sure, 100%. So
that is terrible.
So, you know, that's the last case that we know of, and I wondered, you know, was there any other attack after that time frame? So. You know, there was one in Oakdale in 1987, but nobody ever connected that to him.
And it's interesting to note that in the beginning, they could have connected these earlier had they been talking to each other. So you have to wonder
They were talking to each other, but they really did come up with the conclusion, I think, at the time that really they weren't connected. So, and that, like, again, there was no DNA, there was no, you know,
right.
It was just a different time, so.
It certainly was a very different time. Now, tell us a little bit about yourself. We can get a little personal here. When you were told about these killings, what was your reaction?
Well, like anybody, it's horrific. It was, very horrifying.
Well, didn't you get scared and did you get scared and leave or what did you do? Tell us about that.
I've had a little bit of post-traumatic stress about it. Yeah, sure. You know, being in Sacramento at the time that this occurred with the East Area Rapist running around and living alone as a 19-year-old woman, that was terrifying enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then to know somebody who was killed by the same perpetrator, of course, I didn't know that until years later. I just knew the victims, and I had no idea who had killed them or why. But I, you know, obviously that's just disturbing to have that kind of a visual in your mind. So
exactly. Now,
It does tend to make you want to leave.
Right? Yeah.
Well,
now,
yeah.
Did you want to...
Did you want to
expound a little bit more about who you knew, or should we just leave it at you knew somebody?
At the moment, we're just going to leave it there.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Like I said,
I wrote
the book with a pen name on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to leave Sacramento because it was as a 19-year-old girl, when you're concerned about being followed home or attacked or, you know, being hurt in some way by anyone, really, it's not very comfortable. So I found a safer place to be.
Well, that's
hopefully
good. And, I'm sure you're safe. I'm sure it's very, very stressful. And like you said, post-traumatic, it would be unbelievably stressful to be to know one of these victims. I can't imagine what the families are going through. Let's talk about Leslie D'Ambrosia. Am I pronouncing that right? I think I am.
Yeah, you are.
She was one of the detectives. She was one of the detectives. Tell us about her.
Actually, she was with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and she put together an analysis of a profile of who she thought the perpetrator might be, what his characteristics were. And at the time, they had connected, when she did this after 1986, she put this together, and at the time they had connected six of the victims. The dates were from March 13, 1980 until May 5th, 1986. And she just basically put down in her report that they all had died as a result of excessive beatings to the head with a blunt force instrument. And they had ligatures tied around their wrists and ankles. And they had abrasions. They were sexually assaulted. Some of the victims had contusions on their bodies and a possible bite mark, that kind of thing. And they also, in this report, determined that they thought the male victims were eliminated prior to the sexual assault of the female victim. So that this perpetrator used overkill when he killed women because he does women. So, and also
right,
the fact that he
that's...
he was known to attack inside the victims' residences, and which is unusual
so,
because. Go ahead.
Oh, where'd you go? Are you there?
I'm here. Yeah.
Okay. It was unusual because of what were you going to say?
Well, he just a lot of times serial killers will pick up somebody on you know and drop their body in the middle of nowhere, and this guy would go into their homes. He was able to enter their homes in a stealth manner without alerting the victims most of the time, and so they thought he was an accomplished cat burglar, which is you know one of the things that. It made people think that maybe he started out as the Visalia ransacker. But anyway, he had, he just was real organized about what he did. He was real, had a superiority complex maybe. But he, you know, he definitely knew right from wrong, and he brought a kit with him, and he planned his attacks carefully with great attention to detail. He rehearsed his attacks, possibly. He really got better at what he was doing and, you know, just continued. So,
again, very, very frightening. Now, in your book, you do cover all of this. Your book is Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer by Ann Penn. Let's talk, you said you want to talk more about the DNA later in the show. I think this is a good time. Let's talk about the DNA.
Well, let me finish by saying this one thing, too, about because it might be
sure.
important to people who are listening and who may think about someone that they know that fits some of this type of description. But this offender, he's likely to record his crimes. He probably has photographs. He has sketches, writings, newspaper clippings. He probably reads about himself all the time, listens to whatever people are saying, probably why I get nervous sometimes. But he's kept all of these things somewhere stashed and will have, you know, all the different trinkets that he took and all the things that remind him of the crimes that he committed. So,
right.
You know, that's definitely the way that serial killers seem to operate.
Absolutely. And you're very correct in to remind people that perhaps if they know somebody that during that time frame were acting weird or perhaps brought some extra jewelry that they don't recognize. It's just something very simple that could perhaps break this case wide open. And he could, let's face it, he could be dead. He could be, like you said, just decided to give it up. He was done with it. We just don't know. That's the problem. So is there anything else you would like to discuss before we move on to the DNA?
Well, you know, this really is sort of part of one and the same conversation about questions I have about what kind of testing was done on some of the evidence and just things that I hope that they retest now with the forensics that they have. I would love to know, but they probably won't tell me since I'm not anybody they would talk to about it. But I would love to know if they've retested some of the things using the most recent, you know, forensics of the times. So, I mean,
as far back as
2005, they've been able, they can figure out if they want to figure it out. They can take your DNA, figure out the physical characteristics of the perpetrator. And they can also tell with 92% accuracy if the criminal has green eyes or blue eyes. And, you know, yeah, so there's a lot of things that it'd be interesting to know if they've done this yet, and I would assume so, but who knows. The forensics are to the point where, well, even in 2005, they said they didn't think that Dr. Fridakis is who I'm quoting, said, I don't think it's too far out there to say in the future there will probably be a lot less crime than there is today because people are going to realize that when they commit that rape or they commit that murder, they might as well take their driver's license out of their wallet and toss it on the ground because they're going to get that information out of their DNA anyway. And so that would be nice to not have so much crime. for so many murders.
That would be great if we could get the DNA to basically almost practically tell them where they live, but it's getting close, mm-hmm. that's for sure. I'm sorry, continue. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, not at all. So, you know, there were things that he left behind, things that were like matches at the crime scene. For example, if the letter that he, or the poem that he wrote, Excitement's Crave, came in an envelope, if they still had that envelope, does it have any kind of fingerprint evidence on it, palm print, anything? Mm-hmm. You know, who has the envelope? Things like that were things that I wanted to know about. And
right.
So, you know, there's different things that they have that I wondered if they were able to get any fingerprints off of.
Or even saliva. I can't remember exactly when we started, you know, we had self-adhesive envelopes, but, you know, mm-hmm. back in the 60s, 70s.
At this late date, they already have his DNA. They have his DNA from the rape kits and from the murder scene.
Yeah.
They don't, who cares about the saliva on an envelope? Because that's not going to tell us anything more than what we already know. Why I mentioned the fingerprints is because this guy, after 37 years, must have put his fingerprints somewhere in the system. And if we had his
mm-hmm.
fingerprints, then we should, you know, so what if we have his DNA? If we can't match it to anybody, it's not going to work out. So, anyway, I'm just saying that if they have fingerprints somewhere, and I know that there have been here and there, there was a lamp with a fingerprint on it, and they tested someone that they thought it was, and it wasn't him. So people have been cleared, people have been tested, things have gone on that tries to, you know, further the case. And I am thankful, so thankful to law enforcement and all the people out there who investigate this and who do everything they can to try to figure it out. I mean, it's just unfortunate that in this particular case, we haven't found out who he is yet. So,
mm-hmm. And when,
no one,
we may never, but hopefully,
nobody's
hopefully
fault.
We will.
Yeah,
exactly. And hopefully we will find out, because you've written this book and you're bringing more attention to it. That's what's so fantastic.
There's a lot of people out there that are working real hard, and a lot of people out there that are trying to bring attention to it and help, you know, solve the case. So, and I'm very thankful for that as well.
Do you have any other questions before we continue on?
Well, yeah, I do have a question about Detective D'Ambrosia. You said she's with Florida. She's a detective in Florida. Why was she interested in this case from California?
I think it's possible that they asked her to try to develop a profile. That's my impression.
Okay. So she's a profiler in Florida and probably
at the time,
very good one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they just asked her to take a look at it. I was just wondering if there was any connection, you know, between these Sacramento killings and some killings in Florida.
No, not at all.
No. Okay.
Okay. I would like to read that profile someday. I bet it's very interesting.
Well, it's
a
15-page report. It's online. It's on the internet. Anybody can look it up and read it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, we probably have it on Web Sleuth. I just haven't seen it yet, which is a surprise.
Well, we do have a thread. We do have a thread on Web Sleuth, but I have to confess that it's not one that I'm really up on.
Yeah. Well, it's hard when we have, you know, 14 million threads on Web Sleuth to keep track. But this book that Anne has written has really brought this killer again to the forefront. Thank goodness. The book is Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer. And as we continue on with the conversation, Anne, I know you want to give tribute to the victims in particular, and we can't forget them, right?
No. One of the things, too, that I wanted to also address before we get to that has to do with the description of the perpetrator.
Oh, okay.
And if I could, you know, sort of just run through that a little bit.
Please do.
There were a lot of people who said he walked funny and that he appeared to have a genuine stutter, that he was about 5'9", white, blonde with blue eyes, and his natural voice may have been high-pitched. And it sounds like he has a high-pitched voice even when he whispers on those recordings that you played last time we talked. He did have a stutter in some of the cases. Also, Detective Shelby described in his book that the suspect has a pencil-necked, thin guy, medium build, much like a swimmer. And it said it's possibly left-handed, but it also mentions a lot of times with victims that he held a gun in his right hand. So it would make sense to me that he was right-handed because that's what he used the gun hand. And also, it was mentioned, like I said, that he had a stiff or odd gait when he talked, or when he walked, rather. Maybe like he was bow-legged, maybe. So one of the things that would be interesting is if people, especially in the Sacramento area, where this gentleman seemed to have come from, would think about who they knew back then, back in the 70s, that might have fit this kind of a description.
Right.
There were times where he attacked and he had beer with him, or there were empty beer cans there, but nobody ever smelled it on him. And he probably did that to throw people off. I don't know. I mean, he either drank or he didn't, but it doesn't appear that he did. And there were cigarette butts also, but he didn't ever have that smell on him either. So anyway, during the murders, he used a bludgeon with fireplace logs, wrenches, or other things that were available at the scene. So he, you know.
He didn't bring his own weapons then.
Well, he brought a gun and he brought a flashlight, and he probably had a kit of some sort. He was known to have some kind of a bag sometimes that people could hear a zipper opening and shutting. But when it came to the murders, in the beginning, he didn't kill in Sacramento unless he really did kill the Maggiores out in Rancho Cordova while they were walking their dog, but there's no proof of that. But he did have, a kit with him in the beginning, and he did bring the murder weapons with him eventually when he began to do that.
Were they able to make a match on the guns? Do you know?
I don't know about the ballistics evidence. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not an expert. I don't have all the details. There are people who have the files. There are people who know a lot more than I certainly do. But I don't know about that. They didn't say in a lot of these news articles, they didn't talk about the ballistics.
Right.
I think they wanted to keep that to themselves. So.
Right.
Before we move on from the description, is there anything else that you would like to add that we may have forgotten? It certainly was a very compelling description. I mean, this guy just sounds creepy as hell. Bow-legged, I mean, pencil neck. Oh, God.
Well,
somebody out there who recognizes that.
He might have walked with a stiff gait, but I'll tell you what, when he ran, he could run like the wind. I mean, he was up and over a fence in a heartbeat. So,
There's just got to be somebody out there that remembers this guy or knew him casually or something. Like I said, and you know this as well as anybody, Bessie, it takes just one little thing. Somebody has no idea that they hold the key to finding a killer or a serial killer, and it's just one simple little thing that a person doesn't think is important. So, absolutely, if you pick up Anne's book and you happen to be in those areas at that time and this description sounds like someone you know, don't hesitate to pick up the phone and call the police. Do it.
Also,
I'm telling you, that's what they would tell you.
One of the things, too, that might be important to mention, and maybe he got rid of it by now, who knows, somewhere along the way he acquired a tattoo. On his forearm, which was like a bull, like the Schlitz malt liquor bull. He had a bull on his arm. And so
telling.
So if anybody knew anybody that had that back then, you know, that might be something they might remember.
Absolutely. Well, that is a very descriptive description. I think somebody had to see him. So it should hopefully jog somebody's memory if we Let's hope so. Let's hope that's exactly what this says, because that's your whole point of this book, is you want to make sure the victims are not forgotten and catch this guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk about the victims. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to say as somebody who has, like I said, can't seem to get away from this particular case, I'm just a person who has had this story keep popping up in my life, and I've had this experience with it. It's intertwined in my life, not just the one time in Sacramento, but after that with the victims that were murdered, and then also over the years where it just keeps coming back to me, whether I wanted it to or not. I also wanted to say that there are countless others out there who are victims of violent crimes and who are family members of murdered victims, who are just trying to make sense out of what happened to their loved ones and their families. There are others who, just like me, actually, who try to wrap their heads around what happened, why. Anyway, there are a lot of people that are on Facebook and different crime, book clubs, true crime book clubs, extreme murder, mysteries and more. I mean, there's all these different places that people go to try to be able to talk to others about these types of issues. And because when you talk about a serial killer to just your standard everyday person, a lot of times if I try to talk to somebody, they look at me like I'm weird, or they don't understand why I would want to talk about this case. Yeah.
I get that a lot.
And so there's a lot of different people out there in various places and pro boards and different places, and those guys are really trying to solve this crime, and they do a lot of work on it, and I'm very appreciative of that. But, there's a lot of people out there who, like I said, are in the same position where they're trying to understand what happened. They're trying to figure out, what to do, how to make sense of it, how to deal with it, where to put it. And the victims' families in this case, they went through the last 37 years or 35 years or 30 years without being able to share in these people's lives because they were murdered and they were taken from us. And, they had lives to live and they deserved to have that right. And somebody came along and took them away. I mean, they were people that were productive people. I mean, they were doctors and they were lawyers and they were loved and they were, people that were trying to live, all of them were just very valued by their families and by their communities. And this guy, I can't fathom that this is going to go unsolved. So
I hope not.
No, and thank you for keeping it alive, keeping the story alive. And we'll be sure, I don't know if you've done this already, Tricia, but we'll be sure to, post the link to the podcast in the East Area Rapist thread.
Yes, absolutely.
So anybody who's missed it can come back and listen to it, and hopefully we'll read your book and listen to all that you've had to say.
The book is really an appeal. It's an appeal to people to, try to help figure out who they might have known, especially in the Sacramento area, because that's where he began and that's where he may be. Who knows? But we need to move. This is a very dark subject. We need to move from the darkness into the light. And, the only way to do that is to find out who it is and to, how can somebody get away with this? I mean, there's so many unsolved murders everywhere. I know this is not the only one. It's not the only, perpetrator out there that did things like this over time. There's many, many others. But this is the one I get to talk about.
I think it's one of the oldest of the serial killer, in the serial killer realm. We have many other cold cases, murders, but when it comes to serial killing, I think this is probably, one of the oldest, going back to the 60s. And it's well past time for it to be solved. And, and if this guy is still alive, or even if he isn't, the families certainly have a right to know, who did this? Who was this guy? Were there any other strong suspects?
Well, I'm sure there have been, you know, there's been thousands on the list of suspects that they clear very patiently one at a time. I'm not aware of persons of interest. The law enforcement people and people who investigate these crimes are the ones who know. But I know that they just work on it and work on it and work on it. And I'm very grateful to all the law enforcement people who continue to give this attention and try to figure it out. What I would love to see is medical examiners go back and look at the files and try to determine, something new, some piece of information that maybe wasn't noticed before. And it's worth really looking at every piece of evidence and every autopsy report and just, and I don't have the information about what they are doing. This is just what I hope they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and maybe they are. Yeah.
I certainly hope so. Well, Anne, before we wrap things up, is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you would like to? Because the floor is yours. We have time, and I'd love to hear what's on your mind.
Well, like I said, in a nutshell, it's one of those things where, there's been different things come out about this case, and more people are talking about it, and that's really a good thing. But a lot of times, even in the beginning, when they wrote articles about the murders in the 70s and the 80s, what gets maybe forgotten somehow or maybe not touched on or maybe glossed over is the fact that these people were bludgeoned to death and shot, and it was horrific, absolutely horrific. And I guess probably the appeal is to the public to not forget that the East Area Rapist wasn't just a guy who went away and just, they thought he was caught or maybe he wasn't, but who cares because he's gone now. He really continued on and he hurt people and he hurt multitudes of people, meaning their families, their communities, and everybody else that's come in contact with this case and this situation along the way. And it needs to be, solved, and I know that they're trying to. So everybody's trying to get the word out, and that's why I'm here today, too. So.
And you're doing a great job, Anne. Like I said, the book is a very compelling book. And tonight, what you said, Anne, about his description, I've just got to hope and believe that there is somebody who maybe was a teenager back then and will say, that sounded like my goofy, weird neighbor, pencil neck, bow-legged, and just give them a call because you don't know what you have. As I said earlier, you could have that one piece of information and you just probably think it's nothing. Call the police, write it down, email, whatever you have to do, but do it. And
well, the FBI is investigating it, so.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Don't forget, you can call the FBI with tips and also your local sheriff's department, but they are working on it as well, so.
And that gives me a lot of hope because they have some great tools right at their fingertips. So, okay, Anne, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on for this special edition of Web Sleuths Radio. The book is called Murder on His Mind, Serial Killer by Anne Penn. It's about the East Area Rapist. You can get it on Amazon right now. And thank you so much. If anything breaks or you have anything else you want to say, give me a call and we'll have you back on again, okay?
Yeah, and I really appreciate it. And I wanted to thank you, Tricia, and Web for having me on the show again. I know it takes a lot of time and energy, so I do appreciate it. Thank you.
It is our pleasure. You're the one that's working hard, and we're glad to help. So, Anne, you take care, my dear, okay? We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. You too.
Good night.
Bye. Bessie, don't hang up on me. Wow, she's gung-ho. Anne is very dedicated to this cause. She really wants this guy found. And I've had numerous discussions with her about this. It's a very emotional thing for her. She's really dedicated, right?
And that's what it takes. I mean, we're talking about, assaults and murders from years and years ago. The only way they're going to be solved is if people keep talking about them and to have somebody as dedicated as Anne, to keep the word out. I mean, I don't know that it will be solved, but I know that that's what it takes to get them solved, these old cold cases. So
and,
I haven't read her book, but I'm going to read her book tonight, or download it at least tonight.
It's really good. It's really good. And speaking of cold cases, we have about 380 million. Now, that might be an exaggeration on my part, but it feels like it. 380 million cold cases on WebSleuth. And here, people, here's what you can do. You can jump on, join WebSleuth, really easy. You just need an email address and post on a cold case. Just say something like, I'm thinking of your family, and hopefully you'll have more information about your daughter, brother, mother's murder, whatever. Just a note of support, something that's so simple for you to do. Just a note of support can mean the world to people. So don't think you don't have anything to offer. You do. You have something to offer on WebSleuth, and that is just good emotional support for these people, and they need it, and you can give it to them. Right, Bessie?
Absolutely. I mean, if it were my loved one, I would want to know, you know, that people are still keeping it out there and talking and care, that people care.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And also, I think the more we talk about it, it induces law enforcement to work a little harder.
Yeah.
Some detective or, you know, profiler, investigator somewhere will catch on and might think, hey, let me dig a little deeper into this. And it sounds like that's what this case needs. And they have his DNA. So, I mean, hopefully they've put it through CODIS, and I guess they've come up with nothing, but that doesn't mean that it's impossible.
You've got to hope they put it through CODIS, but, you know, sometimes those things just slip through their fingers. Maybe they haven't yet. Wouldn't that be something? If they haven't put it through CODIS and all, that's all they need to do. I wish we could find out. I wish there was a way. But I don't have that kind of charm to call them up and ask that question and have them give me an answer anyway.
No.
Okay, Bessie, my dear, we'll be back Tuesday night.
I don't think this guy just stopped. He may have moved out of the area. But I'm not convinced that he just suddenly just stopped. Not after that many murders and assaults.
Yeah, exactly. That's so rare. I mean, Dennis Rader is the one that everybody points to because he did stop. But what he was doing during that time is he had a job where he got to tell people what to do and to be in charge, and that kind of, you know, calm down his need to kill, but it came right back up again. Hey, I got to tell you who we are having on. It's either this coming Tuesday or next Tuesday, but I'm going to have on a director of this incredible documentary called Mommy Dead and Dearest, The Story of Dee Dee and Gypsy Rose. Do you remember that?
The
woman who forced her child, much of them by proxy, basically, and the child was like 24 years old, and the mother said that she was really 16 and she had cancer and all of these horrible things, and none of it was true.
Yeah.
They had her in a wheelchair, and she met somebody online. They killed the mother, and they escaped. Anyway, this documentary is so compelling, and it's coming out.
Wow.
I believe within a week. I should have had this information in front of me, and I didn't grab it. But I'm hoping to have the incredible director on Tuesday of this documentary. If it's not this Tuesday, it will be next Tuesday. So that is something to look forward to. Do you remember that case, Becky?
I do. Kind of vaguely, but I do remember that one. Is this the first documentary about it? Seems like something
As far as I know, it's Erin Lee Carr. She's the director, and she's brilliant, just brilliant. It was Dee Dee Blanchard was the mom, and Gypsy Rose Blanchard was the daughter. They interview Gypsy from her prison cell, and your heart breaks for her. Her mother just used her and got her sick, continually getting her sick just to make money and to get attention. It was just
like a Munchausen by proxy.
Yeah, Munchausen by proxy, the worst. But then again, it's horrible, but you can't help but read about it and find out about it because it's so baffling. Who would do this to their child? You're right, a lot of people. Bessie, you're absolutely right, and that's the problem with the world.
Yeah.
We need to stop it. Bessie, you and I need to run for president. I'll run for president if you guys, or maybe vice versa. We can fix this.
No.
This in a second.
You do it.
Okay, you just watch from the sidelines and laugh. That'll be fun.
Okay,
Bessie, thank you for your help tonight. I really appreciate it. And everybody, we'll be back next Tuesday at our usual time, which is 8 p.m. Eastern for Web Sleuths Radio. And thanks again. Be sure and check out websleuths.com. We have a brand new political forum called PolitEvent, and it's a lot of fun. Check it out, websleuths.com. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Trisha.